Today on Against the Grain, it's self-evident that unequal societies like ours are bad for the poor. However, according to my guest, they're also bad for everyone else, including the affluent, not only because inequality affects schools and healthcare, but because it also makes us anxious and unhappy. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll be joined by epidemiologist Richard Wilkinson to discuss our psychological well-being in wealthy but unequal countries. Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. It's no secret that Americans are stressed and anxious. It seems the modern condition. But it might come as a surprise that wealthy but more equal societies have way lower rates of mental illness than wealthy but unequal societies such as ours. The US and the UK, for example, have three times as much mental illness, including four times as much schizophrenia, than more equal, wealthy societies. Richard Wilkinson, co-author of the acclaimed book, The Spirit Level, has in a new work examined the psychological and social toll of inequality. Also co-written with Kate Pickett, it's called The Inner Level, How More Equal Societies Reduce Stress, Restore Sanity, and Improve Everyone's Well-Being. And it's published by Penguin. Wilkinson is Professor Emeritus at the University of Nottingham Medical School and Honorary Professor at the University College London, and he joins me today. Before we get to our psychological well-being, let's start with the general argument that you made in the spirit level. Why is it that inequality is bad for just about everyone, not just for those on the very bottom?
Well, first, we find that a whole range of outcomes are worse in more unequal societies, the countries with bigger income differences between rich and poor. So more violence, more people in prison, lower levels of life expectancy, more teenage births, more mental illness. All those problems actually are problems which have what we call social gradients. They're more common at the bottom of the social ladder. And so in a sense, we're saying something extraordinarily simple, that problems which are related to social status within our societies get worse when you increase the social status differences with bigger income differences. The only surprise is, as you said, that they become more common, not just amongst the poor, but amongst the vast bulk of the population. The biggest effect of inequality on the poor, but even people who have well-off middle-class jobs, well-educated and so on, would probably live a bit longer if they lived in a more equal society. Their children might do a wee bit better at school in these international maths and literacy tests. They'd be less likely to become seriously involved in drugs, and we'd be less likely to become victims of violence. So in that sense, the vast majority of the population in more equal societies do best.
So why would it be that a relatively affluent but not rich person would have a longer life in a more equal society?
Well, inequality is a social stressor. It makes class and status more important. It raises issues to do with status insecurity, status competition. It undermines feelings of self-worth, because if you live in a society where some people are regarded as hugely important and others almost worthless, we all become more worried about how we are seen and judged. And it's very clear that inequality plays this divisive effect. You can see it reducing, weakening community life, making people less likely to trust each other. So social stresses as a whole increase. But central, we think, is the anxieties about how we are seen and judged. You know, do people think you're intelligent, attractive, interesting, or very much the reverse? And of course, we all have worries about how we're seen and judged, and we think that these sorts of stresses are not the most powerful in terms of the horrors you can imagine happening to people if they lose their home or their jobs or something, but these are the most widespread stressors that go on winkling away at us all the time. And we do now have quite an understanding of how chronic stress influences cardiovascular systems, immune systems, changes physiological priorities in a lot of ways, which the results look rather like more rapid aging. You become more vulnerable to a whole range of illnesses and diseases, disabilities, if you're chronically stressed.
Well, lead us through some of that research. How do we know that the stress that people are experiencing, and which has these cascading physical effects, that those are the result of status anxiety?
Well, when we first became aware of how important chronic stress was, when I say we, I mean researchers around the world looking at the big health differences between rich and poor, we immediately started thinking, okay, what are the main sources of stress? And it became clear that rather unexpected results, that status itself is important, demonstrated not only in big studies of human beings where you control out other factors, but also experimentally with monkeys where you can manipulate status by moving animals between groups, where you can give them the same food and keep them in the same compounds, so there are no material differences. Status itself, low social status, is a stressor. But also, friendship turns out to be extraordinarily protective of health. Big studies or summaries of over 150 studies say that whether or not you have friends and involved in community life, have good relationships or not, is at least as important as whether or not you smoke to survival over a follow-up period. But also, in terms of where the stresses come from, there are now studies that show that not just the poor, but all income groups, people in all income groups, are more stressed if they live in more unequal societies. The studies actually show every income group, from the poorest tenth of the population right up to the richest tenth, look at status anxiety, and you see everyone in a more unequal society has more of that anxiety. We feel more judged by other people. We worry more about where we are and what people think of us.
You mentioned a moment ago that friendship has a protective effect on our health. To what degree does inequality affect friendship, and how? I mean, we certainly hear a lot about the epidemic of loneliness in modern society, but is this something that could be laid at the feet of inequality?
What we see is, given the evidence that there is more of this anxiety about status and how we're seen and judged, there seem to be two opposite responses to that. One is that you can, if you're worried about what people think of you, you can be overcome with low self-esteem, lack of confidence. You can start to find social contact too much of an ordeal and withdraw from social life. And it's very clear, lots of studies show that in more unequal societies, community life atrophies, people have less to do with each other. There's also another response based on the same worries about how we're seen and judged, and that is that people talk themselves up. They find ways of, if you like, being narcissistic, talking about their successes and so on, instead of being modest about their achievements and abilities. They start to flaunt them. And you see both processes going on, more common in more unequal societies. But It looks as if because social life becomes more stressful, it inhibits social contact. What we like as human beings, we all value, is being able to sit around relaxed with friends, chatting and joking and so on. But that inequality makes those processes harder. We're less likely to be able to relax with each other.
When you say that there are two responses that tend to take place in response to status anxiety, and that is either low self-esteem on the one hand and narcissism on the other. Does that happen? Do those two responses happen at every level of the class hierarchy, or are people who are poor more likely to have low self-esteem and people who are wealthier more narcissistic, or is it not that simple?
Well, you can get depression at the top of society, of course. It's more common at the bottom of society. There are different forms of narcissism. People used to confuse narcissism with self-esteem. I think that you find both these patterns at all levels in society. We now know that there are parts of the brain which actually occur, found in other mammalian species as well, for dealing with issues to do with status and superiority and inferiority, if you like, dominance and subordination. I mean, you can imagine in a troop of monkeys, it's very important that a low-status animal knows its low status. It knows who the dominants are and how to keep out of their way and be obsequious and so on. We have to be good at processing these kinds of things. And it looks as if these processes to do with dominance and subordination relate to a range of mental illness, not only depression and narcissism, as I've said, but we also find that schizophrenia, psychotic symptoms, psychopathy are more common in more unequal societies. People become out for themselves, and you might feel that, and the different responses, you might feel you accept your inferiority, your failure, your low social status, or you might feel that your life is permanently about fighting against that, feel that everyone is trying to put you down, you're constantly having to maintain your people's respect for you and so on. Or you might assume your superiority to everyone else and think you're really a better human being. I think people at the top sometimes think they're a superior species almost. Or you might feel you're constantly struggling to maintain appearances and get up and so on in society. So these issues take over as such an important dimension of social life and interaction, and it's that is increased, and all those different responses with greater inequality.
So it sounds like that you're arguing that there's a evolutionary basis to maybe not social anxiety, but our receptivity of humans to social anxiety. And if that's the case, can we just stop caring what other people think of us?
No, we are. We have evolved to be very sensitive to what other people think of us, partly in our sort of pre-human existence as apes or whatever. As I said, you have to be aware of where you are in the hierarchy and keeping out of the way of the dominance. But for most of human existence as what we call anatomically modern human beings, i.e. brains the current size and looking as we do now, we lived in extraordinarily egalitarian societies. Hunters and gatherers were very egalitarian, based on food sharing and gift exchange and so on. And in those societies, people were very careful not to risk offending anyone, because people were so vulnerable to each other. And without police or whatever to keep the peace, you have to maintain good relations yourself. And so, you know, we're honed to be very aware of and sensitive to the quality of relationships. And that's why friendship is so protective, because friendship is about recognizing each other's needs, sharing and reciprocity and so on. And on the other hand, dominance and subordination, where instead of sharing, you have to fight for what you can get and learn not to trust others because we're all rivals. And so which kind of social relationship you have has always been absolutely crucial to human well-being. And that looks why, as if it's the explanation of why we are so sensitive and why it's social relationships, social status and friendship, which are such important stressors.
Richard Wilkinson is my guest. He's co-author of The Inner Level, How More Equal Societies Reduce Stress, Restore Sanity, and Improve Everyone's Well-Being. That's published by Penguin. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So one thing that has changed, not since the far past, but even in the more recent past, is that we don't live, most of us do not live in small communities with people who have known us all our lives. We're mobile, we live in densely populated areas, but we often feel isolated from each other. How does that shift, that change away from living in small communities with people who know us, feed into our status anxiety related to social inequality?
Well, I think that in a way, if you're part of a long-term community, you've lived and grown up with the same people all your life and they know you inside out and you know them, in a way your identity is held but in the community. It's not up for grabs. You can't fool people about what you are. But in a society without that long-term community, in our modern atomized societies where constantly we're dealing with people who we've never seen before, all the time our identity, who we are, what we're worth, is up for grabs, can be questioned. You're having to create a good impression on people, on new people, all the time. So we think with the decline of community, these issues to do with inequality, raising those, dramatizing those issues, exacerbating those issues, that we're more exposed, if you like, to the effects of inequality.
How do people, given all of this, given on the one hand low self-esteem, maybe withdrawing from social contact, the narcissism that you've talked about, and you use the term self-curation that people feel they need to do. So there are different social mechanisms that people use to cope with a society where status anxiety is pronounced. What other ways do people handle the anxiety from living in unequal societies? You talk about shopping and consumption of drugs and alcohol.
Yes, I think that those are the important part of this picture. The most obvious way is we do what psychologists sometimes call self-enhance, is through consumerism. You buy goods that show you off well as successful people to others. And there are now a number of studies that show if you live in a more unequal area, you're more likely to spend money on a flashy car or status goods, clothes with the right fashion labels and so on. And it's extraordinary that people will spend vast sums of money just on something that other people will recognize as expensive. So it speaks well of you. And I think that goes with the and it shows in a way that the idea that consumerism is an expression of our innate human possessiveness or something is mistaken. What consumerism is a very alienated way of putting on a good face to other people. It's communicating our self-worth to others. And so consumerism is stronger, exacerbated in more unequal societies, which matters very much if you're thinking of how to move towards climate sustainability, where consumerism is obviously a major obstacle. But as you say, drugs and alcohol, if you're feeling tense, high levels of anxiety, and our societies have appalling levels of anxiety, and given that we live in such comfort and luxury, to find that I think it's nearly 60% of Americans say they are paralyzed by stress, and a fifth of the population have diagnosable mental illnesses. Very similar figures for Britain, which is almost as unequal as the United States. What people do with these anxieties is, of course, use drugs and alcohol to reduce them, to contain them. And given that one of our real pleasures ought to be meeting and enjoying other people's company, as I said, sitting around chatting and joking, you use alcohol to help you relax with others. And young people used to say that drugs like ecstasy, they valued because suddenly felt totally at ease, loving relationships with a bunch of people you're just with for the evening. And in a way, what's so tragic about inequality is that these things to do with social contact are key to happiness and well-being. Lots of studies of happiness show, you know, how many friends you've got, and the quality of your relationships are really crucial. And as I said before, the same is true of health, the protective health effects of friendship. And it's that inequality is cutting us off from, the social contact that matters so much to health, happiness, and well-being. So it's a centrally damaging factor to the quality of human life.
In the United States, there is a whole industry of wellness in which people attempt to deal with stress or ill health on an individual basis, say through yoga or meditation or alternative medicine. What do you make of these efforts?
I think they're an expression of the problems in this area. The high levels of stress and emotional dysfunction, the mental problems that are so widespread. And so people do look for personal solutions. And yet, I think it's very clear that the real issue is, why do our societies suffer from such high levels of these problems? And that's really what we as epidemiologists, as experts in public health, are trying to establish. We have been sorry repeatedly when we hear that new figures come out on the levels of mental illness and stress in a society, and the response is always to want more services, more psychotherapy, more mental health services, and so on, rather than looking at what it is about our society that is creating such very high levels of these problems.
Yes, and you write about how it is taken as a given that certain things happen to people's health as they age. For example, in wealthy, unequal countries, as people get older, their blood pressure goes up. And that is, I think, taken as a given that that's what happens to people with age. And yet you say that there are other societies, non-hierarchical tribal societies, in which this doesn't happen. Now, of course, it could be argued that the reason for that might have to do with the diet of those people or the amount of exercise that they have, but you're suggesting that it actually speaks to inequality.
Well, yes. We, of course, are not arguing that inequality is the only factor that influences these things.
Sure.
Air pollution and diet and exercise, they're all important. And yet we see this background factor affecting everything. And not just having marginal effects on outcomes. So if you look at levels of homicide in more and less equal societies, you find some studies show that there's perhaps 10 times as many homicides per 100,000 population or whatever. And you find the same with teenage births. And the proportion of the population in prison. We're not talking about just 5% more of a problem. We're talking sometimes about 10 times as much. I should really mention how many things are covered. I've mentioned some of them, but bullying in schools is strongly related to inequality. And, of course, if you think of monkey hierarchies, in a way they're bullying hierarchies. The chief baboon is the strongest and the one at the bottom is usually the weakest. It's about status and where you are in the ranking, and that's extraordinarily similar to what the data on bullying in amongst school children shows. But measures of child well-being, we've shown that they're not only much worse in more unequal countries, but also they change fairly quickly with changes in inequality.
Richard Wilkinson is my guest. We'll return with him after this musical break. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the co-author of The Inner Level, How More Equal Societies Reduce Stress, Restore Sanity, and Improve Everyone's Well-Being. The book is published by Penguin, and its co-authors are Kate Pickett and Richard Wilkinson. Richard Wilkinson is Professor Emeritus at the University of Nottingham Medical School and Honorary Professor at University College London. Talk about human nature, which of course is very contested ground, but you've been alluding to it in terms of thinking about how we are affected by status anxiety. What do we know about our natures as humans as it relates to these questions of inequality? Because of course we are frequently told that we're very different from each other, that inequality is hardwired into who we are. And of course, the political assumption that goes with it is to make societies more equal means running against human nature, which involves some kind of leveling violence.
Yes. We argue that human nature isn't fixed, that we have, if you like, the evolved psychology of social strategies that allow us to form very different patterns of relationships. So we know how to play dominance. We know how to deal with dominance issues. You know, you can feel nervous in relation to higher status people and feel that you're inferior in different ways. We do name dropping, we're snobbish and so on, all sorts of ways in which we show our recognition of hierarchy and try and maintain and better our position. But we also have strategies to do with friendship and equality from those hunting and gathering societies that I mentioned earlier. Reciprocity is important. We know how to share and cooperate. And both these different social strategies, patterns of dealing with human relationships, have evolutionary roots in us. And which we use depends on the kind of social environment we find ourselves in. Rather than saying human beings are inevitably hierarchical, competitive, out for themselves, or that they are all have hearts of gold and are generous and mutually supportive, we say that people can be either of these things. And the importance of our work is it shows perhaps the most important trigger or lever to changing these patterns of behavior. In more unequal societies, we are more out for ourselves, we are more selfish, we are less interested in other people, less public-spirited. But in more equal societies, we see the other side. Of course, we all use both kinds of strategy all the time, but the balance between them changes with inequality.
Well, one of the arguments that's attached to the suggestion that it runs against human nature for us to live in more egalitarian ways is connected to the assumption that we all have very different capacities and that really there's no way to create an equal society unless a, you know, really oppressive, artificial one when these differences exist between us.
Well, again, I think there's a popular view that the social hierarchy is a reflection of differences in ability, and sometimes people believe that there are genetic differences in ability. But the evidence is now that although there may be small genetic differences between us in our aptitudes, you know, our ability to, how musical or artistic we are, how good at ball games, how likely we are to be fast readers rather than slow readers, how good we are at maths, you know, a lot of differences in abilities that may have a small genetic contribution to them. That on top of that, there are powerful environmental processes that increase those differences between us. So that, if you have a genetic ability that makes you slightly better at ball games, you'll enjoy them more. You'll enjoy finding you're slightly better than your friends. You'll probably be selected for the school team. You'll get coaching. You'll become much better. And that happens in lots of different areas. And as we learn more about from brain scans and so on, how the brain is affected by the different activities and what we do, we can see that each of these things changes the formation of our brain. So if you learn another language, you can see that the areas dealing with that in your brain get larger. If you learn to dance or learn a musical instrument, you see the same processes. So we argue that it's not an idea that the popular idea that your innate differences in IQ or whatever determine where you end up in the hierarchy, but it's where you are in the hierarchy which influences the kind of abilities you develop. And so any relationship between hierarchy and ability is more a reflection of where you come from leads you to lead a different kind of life and develop your brain in different kinds of way.
In the United States, there's a widely held idea that inequality is the natural result of the entrepreneurial system, that those go-getters who innovate can become very wealthy, those people who don't remain below in the hierarchy of status. And this ultimately, although we might bemoan inequality, is a good thing because it allows us to have an innovative society. What would be your response to that argument?
Well, we can work in different kinds of ways. We think one of the most important ways of reducing inequality, of getting greater equality more firmly embedded in our societies, is not simply through redistribution and dealing with tax havens and tax avoidance and so on, but is to do with extending democracy into the workplace, employee representation on company boards, incentives to the growth of employee-owned companies and cooperatives and so on. And the studies now suggest that those kinds of more democratic company models are actually more, they have higher productivity. There are also studies now showing that looking at the biggest companies, the ones where the CEOs pay themselves most, are less, the shareholder returns are lower than companies where the CEOs don't pay themselves so much. So the big income differences seem bad for companies. And of course, if you do extend democracy into these institutions, you may think your boss should have twice as much as you. I guess a few people would think five times as much. But in the biggest multinationals, CEOs at the top are getting 300 or 400 times as much as junior employees and production workers. So rather than restricting equality, we want to extend it into the workplace.
How does the effects of increasing material wealth and having economic growth differ in poor countries from affluent countries in terms of the well-being of their respective populations?
Yes, that's an important question. People do cling to the idea that what will make us all happier is more economic growth. That is true in poorer countries, but it's no longer true in the rich countries. Basically, that if you're in a poor society where many people don't have access to basic necessities, economic growth and higher material standards are a really important contribution to well-being. But in the rich world, having more and more of everything makes less and less difference. And so you see, when you look at the data, that the early stages of economic growth in developing countries are powerful drivers of improvements in health and well-being and happiness. But in the rich world, that link is broken. In a way, I suppose that economic growth has, in our rich societies, has done its job. It has transformed the quality of our lives. But now we have to turn to other sources of ways of improving the quality of our lives, and we argue, as I've said earlier, that that is a matter of the quality of social relationships, and that's partly why inequality is so important. Reducing it matters so much to the quality of social relations.
But couldn't it be argued that in the United States, where you actually have a substantial section of the U.S. population who live close to the poverty line, who may be food insecure, wouldn't their lives improve with higher incomes?
It will make a small difference, but much more important in the rich countries is how big the differences are, because my experience of whether I'm doing well, enjoying high living standards, is partly due to social comparisons. And actually, you know, any of the cars on the road are much better than any car 50 years ago. And yet we look on ones that are, say, 5 or 10 years old as inferior to the later ones. And these are to do with social comparisons and so on. They're not real reflections of the importance of material standards in themselves. It's interesting, there was a study comparing the experience of poverty in different countries, in countries as poor as India, Pakistan, Uganda, and countries as rich as the United Kingdom and Norway. And they interviewed people in poverty, where it means totally different things. You know, in India, it means living in a shanty without sewerage and water, just perhaps a leaky corrugated iron roof over you. In Norway, it means probably living in a centrally heated three-bedroom flat with a flat-screen television. But the experience of poverty in those very different material conditions was the same. People felt humiliated by it, looked down on, despised. They felt they had failed themselves and failed their families. Powerful feelings of failure and inadequacy and being seen as inferior as a result of being lower on the ladder. So it is a matter of comparisons. How you compare with others in your own society that creates the feelings of poverty.
Epidemiologist Richard Wilkinson is my guest. We're talking about his co-authored book, The Inner Level, How More Equal Societies Reduce Stress, Restore Sanity, and Improve Everyone's Well-Being. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So let's talk about what it would mean to make the societies that we're discussing, the United States, the UK, more equal to the point that there would be really significant effects in terms of people's health, well-being, and so on. You were saying that to raise up the standard of living of people on the bottom a bit would be sufficient to bring the benefits of better health if the rest of the society, if the levels of inequality were reduced. So what are we talking about in practical terms? Is there, in effect, a sweet spot in terms of income, you know, a range of income that you think would make more sense for most of us in a wealthy country to have?
Well, we're just looking at the levels of inequality in different countries now, and we see that going right down to the most equal ones, like the Scandinavian countries, it looks as if it's a good thing and you get benefits from moving at least to those levels of inequality, which I'm supposing you take the gap between the top and bottom 20% of the population. In those Scandinavian countries, the top 20% earn 3.5-4 times as much as the bottom 20%. But in the most unequal countries, like the United States and Britain, the gap is twice as big. And so that gives us an idea of the scale of the problem in front of us. There are lots of ways of doing it. If you look at data for different countries, you can see there was a common pattern that inequality was high in the 1920s and began to reduce in one country after another. From sometime in the 1930s, so in the United States, it's Roosevelt and the New Deal responsible for that. And then inequalities go on reducing until the late 1970s. It's a long-term downward trend in inequality. But then it's reversed from about 1980 onwards, and you get modern rise of inequality, taking us back to levels of inequality last seen in the 1920s. With the importance of class and status moving likewise. So when you try and explain these huge movements, there are important changes in, for instance, top tax rates in many developed countries, including the United States. In the 1960s and 70s, the top tax rates on the very top incomes were 80 or 90%, and surprisingly, our economies did just as well or marginally better. Growth rates were faster then. But there were also other changes. It's when the sort of free market fundamentalist ideology came in from about 1980. Utilities were often privatized. And trade unions weakened. There's a strong relationship between what happens to inequality and the strength of trade unions measured by the proportion of the labor force in trade unions. So I think one of the important things is the whole strength of the labor movement as it first strengthened and then weakened at each end of the 20th century. Probably also the fear of communism, which in many ways was good for capitalism. It made capitalism more humane. It meant that there was development of public services and so on. So it's clear that what we have to have is a sustained, powerful social movement if we're going to make major differences to our inequality. And as I say, in the more unequal countries, we have at least to halve the scale of income differences. We must rein in the top incomes, which I think is best done through top tax rates and economic democracy. and we must improve minimum wages and so on to help the incomes at the bottom.
Well, you raise a really central point here, which is when we look at inequality in the wealthy countries over the last century or more, the strength of the left or the right has had a lot to do with whether inequality has grown or been reduced. And so simple technocratic fixes obviously are insufficient, as you're saying, that a social movement is necessary. But connected to that, I wanted to ask you if you think there are political implications for the ways that inequality affects us on a psychological level. I mean, on the one hand, obviously, increased inequality can make us angry and can make us want to take the kind of social change you're talking about. But on the other hand, it also sounds like it can make us turn inwards. Is there a dimension of this that inequality and the kind of cascading effects on our psyches can make us less likely to come together and take collective action?
I think that's true. I think that inequality means that we become more out for ourselves. We have less to do with each other. So I suspect it gets harder to form coherent social movements. But I think that they are forming. I think with the growth of forms of populism in many different countries, it's been a stimulus to progressive forces in politics. I think also that these issues are not separate from how we respond to climate change. I mentioned earlier that, of course, increased status competition and inequality that lead to more consumerism is a major problem for moving towards sustainability and reducing carbon emissions. But also the fact that community life weakens means people are less public-spirited, they're less aware of the common good. And you see that in lots of different ways. So, for instance, people recycle fewer goods, waste materials, bottles and glass, tins, plastics, paper, all those sorts of things, less recycled in more unequal countries. You also see that surveys of business leaders' opinions show that business leaders in more equal countries think that international environmental agreements are more important. There are a number of those kinds of indications that suggest that if we're going to move towards sustainability, we must become more egalitarian. And, of course, the people who have the biggest carbon footprint, who produce more environmental damage, are the rich. Producing probably 10 times as much for the damaging materials and carbon emissions as the poor. The other thing, of course, that part of this picture is that to move towards sustainability, we need more innovation. We need to change our societies, and people sometimes suggest that inequality is a stimulus to initiative, creativity, and so on, but actually, The data suggests that the picture is rather the opposite way round, that if we've got to invent things to help us reduce our impact on the environment and move towards sustainable transport systems and so on, patents per head of population are much higher in more equal countries. People are more creative, and of course, more unequal countries with more people on drugs, more people in prison, kids doing less well in the maths and literacy tests, we're wasting our talent. And so, you know, the importance of dealing with climate change is an additional reason for tackling the issues to do with inequality, so we can make the changes we have to make.
Let me end by asking you about capitalism itself. Obviously, within capitalism, there are more unequal and less unequal societies. The Scandinavian countries are often pointed to, although some of those countries there The degree to which they are social democratic has been eroded with time, but obviously there is some variation. Ultimately, though, when we think about inequality and the fact that certainly over the last 40 or so years, we have seen inequality grow and grow at the same time as the issues that you were talking about, the climate crisis becoming greater. Do you think that ultimately we should think about changing capitalism itself? Is it enough to make reforms within capitalism? Is the market the problem? How do you come at this question?
Well, I normally, in answer to questions like that, say that there are different kinds of capitalism. The Scandinavian model, with more intervention in the market, works better for human beings than the American or British model. But they're both market systems, both dependent largely on market allocation. But if you think of the problem of moving towards environmental sustainability, where we stop damaging the planet, problem of trying to move towards sustainability from societies where everyone wants to maximize their income because they want to maximize their social status, and every business wants to maximize its sales and profits. You know, that looks a pretty poor place to start from. I do wonder whether we're ever going to make it while those market institutions are producing those patterns and desires.
Richard Wilkinson, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
I've been speaking with the co-author of The Inner Level, How More Equal Societies Reduce Stress, Restore Sanity, and Improve Everyone's Well-Being. That's published by Penguin, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Richard Wilkinson is Professor Emeritus at the University of Nottingham Medical School and Honorary Professor at the University College London. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.